Welcome. You're listening to Surviving Death. In every culture, in every era, people have asked the same question. What happens when we die? In this podcast, I'll explore that question. I'll look at evidence that suggests life may continue beyond the physical body. In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Gregory Shushan about his book, Near-Death Experience in Indigenous Religions. Gregory, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. It's great for you to give us your time. I was really loved reading your book, Near-Death Experience in Indigenous Religions.
Thanks very much.
Can you tell us how it is that you came to write this book?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me on your podcast. It's a very nice honor to be here. So this book is a sort of thematic sequel to my earlier book, which was called Conceptions of the Afterlife in Early Civilizations. That book dealt with afterlife beliefs in the ancient world in ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, India, pre-Buddhist China, and pre-Columbian Mesoamerican civilizations. In that book, I looked at the afterlife beliefs first and then kind of tried to determine if they might have been influenced by near-death experiences. With the new book, what's interesting about it is there are actually accounts of near-death experiences in the ethnographic and missionary and explorer literature of these indigenous societies. And by indigenous societies, I mean mostly small-scale pre-industrial societies in Africa, the Pacific region, and North America. So I was able to look at actual accounts of near-death experiences from different societies, and then look at them in relation to their afterlife beliefs and in relation to each other. So it was in a way a reverse effect, and I was able to actually to really zero in more on the issue of the relationship between near-death experiences and afterlife beliefs than I was able to in the first book.
This book is published by Oxford University Press.
That's right.
Was there any part of working with Oxford University Press where they were much more kind of traditionalist and they didn't believe in all this near-death experience nonsense?
No, actually. The book is very much published exactly how I wanted it to be published, which is great. They didn't sort of interfere in any sort of way. I did the research for the book at the Ian Ramsey Center for Science and Religion at Oxford. So I'm not sure if, there was a certain cachet behind that they thought, oh, well, this guy's been vetted and I had the previous book, but no, it was very, very nice that I was able to put it out exactly how I wanted it. I don't skirt around the issues that might be difficult for people who believe in survival after death and believe that near-death experience might be evidence for that. So I kind of take I wouldn't say I take a middle ground, but I try to have a balanced look at, both sides of the argument and where my research might fit into that debate.
And so have you had an interest in near-death experiences and the afterlife for a long time?
I have, yeah. It goes way, way back, actually, to when I was a kid. I had an aunt who would give me different books on spiritual sorts of subjects, witchcraft and Rosicrucians and things like that. And my mom would give me books about the paranormal or whatever. But it was always in the back of my mind a little bit. And then I was studying Egyptian archaeology at University College London, and we were reading afterlife texts. And I started noticing similarities between thematic similarities. I wouldn't say, very specific things, but ideas about entering darkness, encountering a being of light, and that being of light being associated with judgment of the dead, transformations, these kinds of things, which are very typical of near-death experiences. There was a book by Carol Zaleski called Otherworld Journeys, and she looked at medieval afterlife journeys, European medieval afterlife journey narratives, and looked at them in relation to NDEs. And I had that kind of raised a flag in my mind as I was reading these Egyptian texts. So I just kind of snowballed from there and thought, okay, if this is the case in medieval Europe, and it, you know, maybe it's the case in Egypt, and then I wanted to look at different cultures around the world.
And for your book, where did you get the source information?
For the new book, it's most of the accounts are from the 19th century, but there are some going back much further. I think the earliest one is from 1589, something like that, with early explorers going to America. Mostly those are the earliest ones, early missionaries, and then the earliest ethnographers, anthropologists, writing a little more accurate and detailed scientific reports about these civilizations than earlier explorers and travelers might have done. So that was another place where I had to tread a bit lightly, because you have missionaries who are obviously very critical of the cultures that they're describing. They're there to, save their souls, ostensibly. They're not there to say, oh, here's what these people believe. Isn't it an interesting example of diversity in the world? It was really more, highly critical of them. And then with the a lot of the explorers as well, they're trying to justify kind of imperialist activities of going in and taking resources and land, or in the case of Africa, taking slaves. We have to look at these accounts with a grain of salt. But what was interesting about them is, for the most part, despite the racist or ethnocentric comments found in these accounts, the content actually often matched up with what later ethnographers and anthropologists found. So I think there is a degree of reliable reporting there, aside from the fact that it would not really make much sense if these people are reporting near-death experiences in all these cultures, and to say they're just making it up. So while they have to be read carefully, I don't think they're entirely fictitious.
And I suppose you spend a lot of time wading through writing of these people from all these years ago, because it may have been filtered through their own ideas of life and the afterlife, and they would have their own different skills and powers of insight.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's very much the case. And some of the accounts will be very fragmentary, like mentioning some account that they had come across where these ridiculous people believe that somebody actually left their body and came back to it and saw a vision of one of their satanic deities or whatever. At the core of that, there's clearly a reference to a near-death experience, which needs to be taken seriously. But that person's interpretation of it is, for my purposes, sort of beside the point. But there is, the amount of literature I trawled through was really was quite vast. And I had, it was about almost a five-year project, about four and a half years. So it was roughly a year to each continent that I was dealing with. And then, supplementary research beyond that at different times before and after, really. So it was a matter of, there are no books about NDEs in Africa or NDEs in Oceania or whatever. So it was a matter of just wading through many, many ethnographies until I found a discussion of the religion. And within that discussion of religion, there might be a description of an afterlife. And within the discussion of an afterlife, there might be a reference to an NDE. That's generally how it played out. Or sometimes there would be collections of myths, and the myths would have, shamanic otherworld journey aspects or NDE aspects to it, sorts of themes embedded in these myths.
Could you give us an overview of the three different areas that you cover in the book?
Sure. Africa was, I'll tell you in the order that I actually researched them, because that was a kind of how the book played out. I started with Native Americans, so that was North America, including the present-day United States and Canada and northern regions. And that was continent, really. So I had to divide it into different areas. So the eastern woodlands and the southwest and the plains and all that, because they sort of correspond to cultural groups, but not entirely. And then I did Africa, which is really sub-Saharan Africa, because the North was so pervasively influenced by Islam and Christianity as well, to a certain extent. So I was really trying to look at these societies before they had a lot of external influence from a non-indigenous religion. In Africa, that was the most difficult, but still there, even where there was conversion, there was a lot of indigenous elements that still survived in local religions. So Africa, I also sort of divided regionally. And then the Pacific is the most complex and the most vast region that I looked at, because it included Polynesia, Melanesia, New Zealand, and Australia. Well, New Zealand was part of Polynesia. So it was really that in itself was a even more cross-cultural survey than either North America or Africa. There were kind of fewer similarities between all these groups of religions. Oh, Micronesia as well. I forgot that one. So so that ended up, you know, that could have really been a book in itself of a cross-cultural survey just within the Pacific. So it was a very complex thing to just on an organizational level to get my head around.
Could you give us a couple of examples of the North American stories that really do sound like near-death experiences?
Sure. Off the top of my head, it's a bit difficult, but there are in North America, there were probably the most overt examples of near-death experiences. So the distinction I'm making is that ones that were related in the context of this happened to me or this happened to somebody I knew. There's often these were related when a traveler or ethnographer went to them and said, so what do you believe about the afterlife? And they would reply something to the effect of, well, my uncle died and went to the other world, and he encountered this being, and he sent him back because he said he needs to go return to Earth to tell everyone about the glories in the other world and give a description of the other world. So the NDE would actually be used as an example as well as evidence for their belief in an afterlife. So one of the earliest ones was recounted by Thomas Harriot, who was a British explorer. He was also a fluent speaker of the Algonquin language. And this is about 1585. So they asked some Algonquin Indians in the eastern woodlands what they believed about the afterlife. In reply, they told him that there was a wicked man who was dead and buried, and then he revived. And when he revived, he claimed that his soul had journeyed westward to a hellish realm and then was saved by a deity who made him return to his body. He was the purpose of that was so he could tell his people how to avoid going to this hellish realm themselves. And then interestingly, a second one, NDE, that was described to Harriet was a man who left his body during his own funeral. So he saw his body, and then he walked along a path to the other world. He met his deceased father, and his father sent him back to tell his people about the happiness of the other world. So there's a not only promise of a better afterlife, but there's a warning about a more, problematic afterlife. So there, with the Native American stuff, I found, 30-something examples or references to actual historical NDEs. And then on top of that, there are many, uncountable myths about people who journey to the other world and come back to their bodies. And they are very similar to NDEs in many ways. And my suggestion is, or my theory is that those myths were based on NDEs, but it's so clear to me that this is the case. And there are even examples where some of the native peoples themselves said, our beliefs are based on these experiences, that it kind of goes beyond just being a theory. I actually look at it as an established fact.
And when it comes to the African material, it seemed like examples were quite scarce.
They were very scarce. And that was an interesting thing about this book in general, and kind of something that formed its character, that it wasn't just a question of saying everybody around the world has these NDEs and they're all the same and everyone looks at them the same and everyone has the same beliefs. And it's this, you know, universal experience, and it's all about happiness and reward and love in the other world. That's not really what's going on in the cross-cultural survey. So in Africa, not only were there very few, but quite a lot of them were in a context where they were the NDE itself was seen as a sort of frightening aberrational event, something that if somebody had an NDE, they should be avoided. I found accounts where people were stoned to death after reviving from an NDE, or a woman who came back to life. She was a human sacrifice, and she came back to life surrounded by a lot of other bodies that had been sacrificed. And she said, I went to the other world and I was sent back because I wasn't presentable because I was naked. So I'd like to get dressed and then you can kill me again and then I'll go back. So it's a very different, and they did it. So, you know, they respected that wish, killed her and let her, after getting dressed, and let her go back to the other world. So it's a very different, often very negative perception of NDEs. I'm not saying that it's negative on the from the perspective of the person having an NDE, but from the surrounding culture that they're in. So there's also accounts of somebody waking up on their deathbed and their loved ones fleeing in terror, whereas in other societies, you know, in the modern West and the UK or in the US, if somebody's on their deathbed and you think they're dead and they wake up, you're going to think, wow, what an amazing miracle, and you're going to embrace that person and be very happy that they're back. But with a lot of these African examples, it was very much not the case. So the issue was the problem I faced was how to explain that, how to explain this very different African attitude towards reviving from death and explaining what happened in the other world to the Native American one. And I think the key is that the Native American examples, they have these traditions of visionary experiences and shamanic practices of deliberately trying to go to the other world to encounter ancestors and deities and bring back different kinds of rituals and knowledge about the other world. And in Africa, they didn't really have that tradition. Their shamanic type activities were really more focused on sorcery, avoiding sorcery, possession, and those kinds of more negative behaviors of spirits in the other world. So while the Native Americans welcomed these spirits into their lives and wanted to go visit them, in the African case, it was really a matter of avoiding them. So they had a lot of strictures against touching corpses or being around corpses. And then possibly the most interesting thing is as far as the incidence of NDEs in Africa was that burial practices often seem to limit or even preclude the possibility of somebody coming back to life. So they would often bind corpses and then bury them. So if the person did wake up, there's no way they would be able to, you know, come out of the grave or anything. They would also sometimes kill people who they thought were certain to die. And then there was also a very culturally distinct attitude towards death among a lot of African societies, where if a person believes that death is inevitable, they just kind of give into it, and it's not, dying isn't quite as fearful. It seems a little bit paradoxical given the other attitudes towards death, but there's a sort of fatalism where, but not in a negative way. It's more of a, you know, deep radical of a person's own faith. So they were quite willing to die if they thought they're going to die, and would sometimes even request to be put out of their misery, so to speak. There were also practices where elderly or sick people would be abandoned out of earshot, left to die. And again, that would be, it's more of a cultural thing rather than, you know, a punishment or a horrific thing as we might see it. There was one case where a missionary came upon a dying woman in the woods somewhere and tried to quote unquote rescue her. And she just said, you know what, go away. This is how we do things. Don't interfere. It's my time to go. And it's possible she could have been saved. So it's a very, different way of looking at death. And I think that really impacted the way African cultures processed near-death experiences and didn't quite to their traditions and beliefs, except in negative ways, is something to be suspicious of.
So you did find one or two NDE accounts, though, didn't you?
I did, yes. Yeah. And what was interesting about that, there was a kind of exceptions that prove the rule, especially with the Zulu, for example. There were a couple of NDEs from the Zulu, as along with afterlife myths of people going to the other world and coming back. So these things really seem to go hand in hand. Their afterlife beliefs were a little bit more like what we see in typical NDEs, and their myths were also along the same lines. And that's a pattern was reflected in North America too. So it seems like cultures that are more open to afterlife beliefs that record accounts of them also have beliefs that correspond to those experiences. However, there are some examples in African accounts, including the Zulu, where they're very much like NDEs up to a point. For example, there's sometimes the protagonist will follow an animal into a hole, and that's how they get into the underworld. But everything else is very similar to an NDE, and they are very clear that that actually happened to a living or related individual. So these sort of process of mythologization is pretty evident in a lot of these accounts. There's ones that very very much seem like a documentary NDE, ones that seem like they're sort of on the way to becoming an afterlife belief, and then there's full blown myths and beliefs in religious context.
And moving on to the third area of the world that you cover in the book, in Oceania, they seem to be much more accepting of the concept than Africa.
Yeah, that's true, especially in Polynesia. There's some very clear Hawaiian NDEs, ones I read very much like typical ones in the modern West. As well as from other regions of Polynesia. They also had shamanic soul journey practices, and they had the practice of what's called soul retrieval, where if a person is dying, they believe that their soul was leaving the body, so they would send a shaman, their consciousness of a shaman, after that person to try to bring their soul back. So there are this whole sort of complex of afterlife beliefs which are related to NDEs and practices which seem to be related to NDEs as well. There's a sort of chicken and the egg issue of what came first, the shamanic practices or the actual spontaneous NDEs. And I think the logical thing, given that NDEs happen spontaneously to people around the world, is that NDEs came first, and that in many cases, shamanic otherworld journeys are attempts to replicate NDEs.
I found it interesting that on Tahiti, it was almost like they made a lot of effort to keep people who were alive and who were in danger of death, and their bodies would lie in state as well for a long time after they died. It's kind of the opposite of Africa.
Yes, it's exactly the opposite. And so it's no coincidence, really, that in a society where they make a lot of effort to keep someone alive who they think is dying, or to bring them back, as in the soul retrieval practices, that they're going to be more, that NDEs will happen more often, and that they're going to be more open to hearing what those people had to say when they do come back. And that was the case more often than not in the North American examples too. The interesting thing about the Oceania region was, as I said, it was a sort of vast cross-cultural comparison itself, because Melanesia also had a lot of NDEs and a lot of different kind of soul practices. but they also had a sort of diversity of burial practices and diversity of attitudes towards the afterlife. Micronesia, I found no NDEs at all. That's partly because of there was less field work done there in general. Australia, the focus was much more focused on shamanism and shamanic journeys to the afterlife rather than NDEs. There were a couple of, you know, marginal NDE cases there. So that ended up being almost a microcosm of the whole study, because the situation in Micronesia and Australia, their burial practices were more consistent with what was going on in Africa, and their attitudes towards the dead were more like what was going on in Africa than they were to Polynesia or North America and Melanesia to extent. So again, it was kind of replicating the study as a whole. The cultures that have burial practices that don't encourage somebody to, quote unquote, come back to life, come back from the dead, and that inhibit that possibility, don't express as many NDEs, and their afterlife beliefs are less consistent with descriptions of NDEs.
Did you find that culture would play a role in how people experience and what they see during the NDE?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And that's really kind of where the whole debate about cross-cultural NDEs started. You know, is this a universal phenomenon? And there are definitely cultural differences in how people experience NDEs, as well as individual differences. Some of them are, you know, really quite surreal. There was one example, I think it was a Melanesian example, where a man is climbing up a ladder of a house, and there are babies helping him on each step of the way. And then he gets to this other world where there are a sort of industrialized activities going on, people producing Western goods. And then he sits on magnetic scales, and a loudspeaker comes on and weighs his actions. So it's a sort of a combination between, you know, almost hallucinogenic imagery with actual NDE characteristics, which is, you know, he described leaving his body, ascending to another world and encountering all these beings. So the idea of him seeing this people building Western goods and industrialized areas, that's a very cultural thing, what they used to call cargo cults in the Pacific. There was this notion that people from the West, white people, were some kind of spirits or deities, and that their cargo, the industrialized items that they would bring to these countries, were, you know, these very desirable, almost sacred items. So that gets wrapped up in this individual's near-death experience, because it's a spiritual episode which he's relating to these, you know, cargo beliefs. So it's yeah, I would say NDEs are very much colored by a person's individuality as well as their culture. But having said that, there are also cross-cultural similarities on a more thematic level that are, you know, quite predictable in many ways.
And when we look at people in modern life who have had NDEs, for them it's really can be a big transformative experience in their life, and change it will change their whole direction. Did you find any accounts of that happening?
I did, yeah. Again, mostly with the Native American material. Often people, the Dukri as well. Often people who had NDEs would become a shaman or a healer or a prophet, or have some kind of transformative fruits of the experience, which they would then share with the rest of the culture. So it was almost had a social and cultural benefit of the NDE. I mean, we sort of see that now with a lot of these very you know, New York Times bestsellers, I Saw Heaven and that sort of thing, which become almost a new age religion in itself. There are a lot of NDE organizations that are very much like sort of spiritual support groups and sort of quasi religions. So But I think the difference is that a lot of in these small scale indigenous societies, it's more related to the benefit of the community and the effect that it has on the community rather on transformation of the self. So the transformation of the self does happen, but that's not the important thing as far as they're concerned, I think.
Did you come across anywhere where there were groups of people that had no belief in the afterlife at all?
Occasionally, yeah, there are a few, particularly in Africa, though more often than having a disbelief about afterlife, it was more a case of they don't know. And what's really interesting about that actually is they often said, how should we know? Nobody we know has ever been there and come back. So that's almost proving the idea that NDEs are often responsible for people's belief about the afterlife. If someone says, how should I know? I've never been there. But then in another culture that believe it and says, oh yeah, we know all about it because so-and-so went there and came back. This, by the way, is, I was just going to interject this idea about people's, extraordinary experiences influencing religions goes back at least to Alexander Lang, who was a 19th century, he wrote the series of fairy books, Blue Fairy Book and Red Fairy Book, and he was also interested in psychical research. So he was one of the first to talk about this idea of spontaneous, unexplainable, unusual experiences happening to people, and then those experiences being translated into religious or spiritual beliefs. There's a contemporary scholar, David Hufford. He discovered sleep paralysis or codified and helped to explain it, which is a phenomenon where people feel like they're being immobilized, something sitting on their chest. It's a sort of between sleep and dream nightmarish state. And it has these similarities between cultures, which is the feeling of malevolence in the room or wherever they happen to be, the threat, the immobilization. And Hufford found that these experiences occur all over the world, but that some people say it's an old hag, some people say it's an angry ghost or whatever, depending on the culture. So, and he called it the experiential source hypothesis. So a lot of the discussion about culture and its relation to experience and religion has been, sort of following on from Hufford's work to some degree.
Did you find any accounts of what will be called deathbed visions?
I did. Yeah, I didn't really go into them a lot. I noted them when I ran across them for the most part, but they were exceptionally common. And I think because it's a sort of simpler type of experience than NDEs, it's a kind of single event. They were so obvious in the literature and described in pretty much exactly the same way they are in the modern West. It's a spirit or ancestor appearing to you as you're dying. So it's very unambiguous. Another thing that was really unambiguous was out of body experiences in contexts other than NDEs. Sometimes there would just be a reference to either shamanic or a spontaneous account of leaving the body. And, that's not really a sort of debatable type of experience. Either you leave your body or you don't. Whereas, some real hardcore skeptics will say there's no such thing as a near-death experience because they're all different in other cultures. I don't go for that argument, but I can understand how they get to it because of the differences between cultures. But something like a deathbed vision or an out-of-body experience, there's not really much room for contention there, I think.
Did you find all around the world that there were shamans who were in some way simulating near-death experiences?
That's a cultural thing as well. The function of shamans, I think, differs quite a lot in these different societies. Technically, some anthropologists will tell you not to use the word shaman at all, except for in cultures that use it themselves in Western Asia and Siberian sort of areas. But as far as, you know, using the term in a broad way as a sort of ritual healer, in North America and in Polynesia and Melanesia, definitely they would have these sort of apparently deliberate experiences in order to replicate an NDE. In some cases, especially in Melanesia, they would actually sometimes bludgeon themselves in the head or whatever in order to bring about these experiences. Sometimes there would be a ritual death involved where they would simulate death with actual physical harm, but it was still very clear that they're trying to replicate what happens to a person when they die. This was much less often the case in Africa, once again, where the shamanism was more about sorcery and healing and things like that.
So if they were causing themselves physical harm, it's an indication that they had recognized that people who die and then spontaneously recover did actually experience something. They're trying to copy that, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
In all your research, did you come across any beliefs or indication that they got an idea of reincarnation?
Sometimes. There are a few examples in a couple of Native American cases where they have memories of the state between lives, which is pretty uncommon, but really interesting when you do run across it. Reincarnation beliefs were quite common in throughout Native America in general. The link specifically with NDE is a little bit less common. A lot of reincarnation beliefs in Africa as well, but often coming back as some kind of animal, often a snake. It was a sort of animistic belief there where they often believe spirits were sort of present in natural objects or in the woods or things like that. So often ancestor spirits were considered present in the local village or in the local spirits, and they could either be benevolent or malevolent depending on the spirit. I think reincarnation was a little bit less common in the Pacific though.
And I suppose finding all the information you have goes against those skeptics who would say modern day NDEs, they're people, they've read about it or they've heard about it on the TV and they're just copying the Tunnel of Light and the Life Review.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where I'm on much firmer ground with this book than the previous book. As I mentioned, the previous one looked at beliefs and tried to speculate as to whether those beliefs were influenced by NDEs, because there are so few examples of documentary NDEs from the ancient literature. China was one exception. There were quite a lot from ancient China. So that already establishes on a sort of documentary factual basis that these were going, happening way back in history. But yes, the examples in the new book are so unambiguous. Reported by Western ethnographers and who are scientifically trained to be, I wouldn't say skeptics, but have a scientific rationality about them, and there are quite a few of them who kind of got here before I did. Irving Hollowell is one. Aku Holtkrantz. They both kind of hit on this, These people are having these spontaneous experiences that are very much like shamanic experiences, and they're saying their afterlife beliefs were based on them. So, when mainstream anthropologists of the 19th century up through the middle of the 20th century are noting these things in a sort of objective way, I really don't see that there's any the information. And this book comes, straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, from the people who actually have these experiences and are talking about their beliefs.
Could you tell us more about your previous book, Conceptions of the Afterlife in Early Civilizations?
Sure, yeah. That one, as I mentioned, there was really very rarely any context for documentary or historical recording of events in ancient civilizations. So in Egypt, for example, hieroglyphic writing was really a sacred language, so it was used for a religious text for the most part, ritual texts. So there's no example of this person died and came back to life and he was my uncle and this is what he said. So in that case, it was really a matter of what do they believe about the afterlife as revealed in the ancient texts, and is it possible that those beliefs were rooted in some ancient NDE, which is not in the historical record, because again, they just didn't talk about things like that. There was no personal narrative. So in a sense, it was speculative in that way. But the fact that I looked at, six ancient civilizations and compared their afterlife beliefs and found 8 or 9 very consistent, almost universal elements to afterlife beliefs that matched up to the NDEs, I thought there's a very good case that afterlife beliefs around the world are generally rooted in NDEs. That was validated by the ancient Chinese one examples, because they very clearly had these documentary NDEs going back to at least the 8th century BCE. There are references to NDEs in some of the ancient Vedic Indian texts, where there aren't really personal accounts there, but there's medical religious texts where they talk about NDEs, so it's clear that they were aware of them. And there's one ancient Nahua or Aztec example of a princess who had a near-death experience, and that's a pretty clear historic one. Those are sort of the only non-mythical or non-religious text examples. But beyond that, there are, in ancient Mesopotamia, there are a lot of examples of myths of people dying, traveling to the underworld and coming back. There are a lot of very obvious literary embellishments to them. But again, the theme and the core NDE experiences are all there. So it's almost like the onus is on somebody to explain why the NDE would not be responsible for a myth about a journey to an afterlife and a return that reads very much like an NDE. So if you see what I mean. So it's, while I say it's speculative, I also say it's completely logical and rational to look to this very specific experience to explain a very specific belief that corresponds to it.
And do you think the concepts of heaven and hell sprung out of near-death experiences?
I think it's very possible, if not likely. There are examples of negative near-death experiences in modern times. Took some time and some research for people to come to grips with that they actually do exist. They're still in the minority. Not many people do report them. And they seem to be a little more confusional and sort of a hallucinatory, jumbled. So it's possible that, these kinds of nightmarish NDEs, or maybe we should call them nightmarish NDE type experiences, I'm not sure, would be responsible for sort of hellish beliefs. And the fact that most accounts of NDEs are of a more positive realm, it's very likely that would be responsible for beliefs in heavenly afterlife. I think it's even more likely that it's responsible for beliefs like such as dualism, just the very concept that people can leave their bodies, or that I guess more fundamentally that we are not our bodies, that there is something to us that is not just this body, that there's a sort of intuitive idea that the body and the soul are two different things. And I think that's very much related to NDEs.
So yourself, do you believe that NDEs really are an example of the human soul leaving the body?
I would say I try to keep as much scientific objectivity as I can about this. I will say that I don't think any of the attempts to explain NDEs in, materialist physical forms, such as, the dying brain or lack of oxygen or whatever, none of them are able to explain the NDE and all of its similarity and diversity around the world. They're not able to explain accounts of people who claim to have received information in the other world, which they couldn't have known otherwise, and it turns out to be true, such as meeting somebody who they didn't know had died, and they come back and found out that that person died at the same time they were having their NDE. People meeting relatives who they didn't know from a portrait. These things are, technically anecdotal, quote unquote, but they're widespread. I found them in the small-scale societies as well. There's often a concern to prove that these things happened. They want to say, I went there and I saw so-and-so and they gave me this message. So it's often a person that other people will know, or they gave them some other kind of information to be able to prove it. I know I'm waffling about my own beliefs, but so I would say that the more I've read about it, the more compelling I find the idea of that, that they are really indications of survival after death. And I also think that in some ways that explanation is a better explanation for the cross-cultural similarities and differences than a dying brain type of hypothesis. But ultimately, those are, only one of those options can be true, that near-death experiences are the product of a compromised brain, or that they're evidence of a genuine afterlife. And another thing that's in the favor of the pro-survival camp is NDEs can happen when somebody's not actually near death at all. That if they fall off a cliff but land totally unharmed and still have a near-death experiences with all the bells and whistles. That's a really interesting subject. So that's very clearly not a dying brain or a lack of oxygen or whatever. Why it can happen when someone's not really actually near death is another can of worms.
Yes, when I talked to Dr. Penny Sartori, she was saying that when she was working in the ICU as a nurse, there's somebody there that had a near-death experience, and she took their blood almost immediately and did look at it to see if there was a lack of oxygen, but it was just normal.
Yeah, Penny's research is interesting, and other researchers who have done this thing where they put symbols on the top of the hospital equipment in the cardiac ward, and hoping that the person will notice the symbols while they're out of their body and come back and accurately say what they are. I mean, that would be a proof of dualism, which is a paradigm shifting idea. So Penny didn't get any. Unambiguous hit. Neither did Sam Parnia with the AWARE study. But instead of their research, the interesting findings of their research getting the media attention goes to, I would say the skeptic community attention goes to, these were failed experiments. Sam Parnia claims in his report on the AWARE study to have pinpointed a cardiac patient's consciousness still being conscious while they were technically dead. One of Penny's most interesting findings was people who were revived from a near-death state were able to accurately describe their resuscitation process, whereas people who were asked who didn't have an NDE type experiences were asked the same question. They were not able to describe it accurately, whereas the ones who had an NDE and claimed to be out of their bodies did describe it accurately. So, again, there's these sort of hints at evidence, but unfortunately, the sort of grand goal of these studies not being achieved tends to unfairly categorize them as not having produced any solid evidence.
And the thing is that there is lots of accounts of people who have near-death experience, and they do go and see something which is later verified.
Mm-hmm. But placing pictures on top of medical equipment is exactly what these people have already done.
That's true. Yeah, that's a very good point. I guess the difference is these they haven't done them in these controlled laboratory settings. So I don't know. I mean, I don't really think the argument of or the dismissive argument of saying it's all anecdotal. I don't think that's necessarily very valid because, I'm coming from a humanities, religious studies, anthropology background, so all of our data is anecdotal. All we know is what people tell us. So it's a kind of difference in the degree to which we respect our sources' claims, I think.
So next, are you working on a new book?
I am, yes. A couple of things. One, I want to just put together an anthology of NDEs from around the world and throughout history. And I would also like to do a book on Greek NDEs and afterlife beliefs. Both of those are going to be a little bit more, a little bit less academic, less of a kind of scholarly bent, and more of a kind of accessible to non-scholars.
The two books that you do have at the moment, they're out on Amazon, aren't they?
They are, yes. Conceptions of the Afterlife and Early Civilizations. That's been in paperback for a couple of years. The new book, New Death Experience in Indigenous Religions, had just came out and hardback, but we'll have a paperback one day. And I'm very proud of the cover of that one, by the way. It's a really interesting image. It's of a drawing by a Kiowa Native American named Bianchi. And the title of the image in the Smithsonian Institution archives just says, a drawing of his vision to the spirit world. So, it's really interesting to have an NDE, a visual NDE, or at least a shamanic afterlife journey. It's not quite clear which it is, as the cover of this book. And it's the first time this image has ever been published anywhere.
And do you have a website?
I do, yes. It's just www.gregoryshushan.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for giving us your time and coming onto the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. And thanks for the interest.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting conversation. I really did love the book. It was fascinating.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. Thanks.
That was an interview with Dr. Gregory Shushan about his book, Near-Death Experience in Indigenous Religions. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon, sold over 2,000 copies, and has more than 50 five-star reviews. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.